discuss this and more for the full hour will be Dr. Adam Lowther. He's a senior fellow at the Center for National Interest in Washington, D.C. He is the author of numerous books and articles on national security topics, previously served also in the United States Navy. Adam, welcome to MidRats.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Hey, just kind of to get things kicked off, reason I reached out to you and said we got to get Adam on as a guest is anybody can just do a quick Google search over at The Diplomat. You did a response to a previous guest of ours, Robert Farley, who ran a critique of your 2011 article. And your kind of reply to him, the title was Naval Enthusiast Air Diplomacy Wrong. And we just had a few shows this year where we talked about, you know, the air-sea battle concept. We had some guests on that talked about offshore balancing, the Pacific pivot, and things of that manner. But all these guests really came from the naval point of view. But we often forget, I think, as you pointed out in your response, we in the Navy like to point out that the Earth is 70% covered by water, but it is 100% covered by air and space. And in that respect, perhaps we're not getting a fully fleshed out view of air diplomacy or the best way to use our national aviation assets. Where are some of your critique coming from? And on the naval side of the house, what do you think are some of the big picture items that perhaps we're missing as we look to that concept?
Well, I think in terms of air-sea battle, you know, it's many people have some perceptions about it that it's this new strategy that, you know, the Navy and the Air Force have gotten together because of tight resourcing, which everybody admits that the next few years at least, perhaps more, are going to be very tight physically. And so with fiscal times tight, the Navy and the Air Force have gotten together to kind of muscle out the Army since they've received a disproportionate share of defense spending over the last decade. And the reality is that's not really what air-sea battle is. I mean, there is, with the Pacific pivot, I think that's made pretty clear that while China may not be an adversary today, it is certainly an economic competitor. While it is also a trading partner, but there's also this perception that China may be a military competitor or adversary in the future. And if you know you read the history of great powers, there's some reason to believe that to be so. And so in that, I think particularly with the move to Asia, the Air Force and the Navy have looked at the distances and looked at the geography in the region, and they said, hey, look, if this thing goes to a shooting war, then this is our turf, and the Army and the Marine Corps will have less of a role. And so in thinking about, well, does that make sense? And the Air Force and the Navy have come to the conclusion, yeah, it does make sense that we'll play the bigger role. And then they've been jockeying for position in terms of, well, what role will each of the services play in a joint combined campaign? So there's now some debate back and forth between myself, you know, and I was an old bosun's mate. So I spent my time at sea on destroyers and frigates. So I certainly understand the naval aspect, but I think a lot of people have forgotten the role that air power plays and the role that air power will play in the future. And in particular, I mean, everybody understands, you know, there's an old saying that the Air Force has that no soldier or Marine has been shot at from the air since 1953, I think, or 52, something like that. So over 50 years, and that's because of air superiority principally provided by the Air Force. And so most people think of the Air Force and they think of its dominance of the skies. But in Asia in particular, We don't have the kinds of relationships that we have in Europe, for example. So the idea that we're going to go in, we're going to have allies, we're going to have bases, and we're going to be able to dominate the skies of Asia like we were able to dominate the skies of Europe through our large presence and therefore our persistent air coverage, it's not going to work that way in Asia, and because we don't have those types of relationships, and we're unlikely to have those types of relationships in the future, with the exception of Japan and Korea. So as we think about how do we accomplish our strategic objectives in Asia, a lot in the Air Force are thinking, well, geez, we're not going to be able to have allies. And many of the Asian nations that we, the U.S., deal with in the region have said, whoa, don't call us allies. You can call us friends. Maybe we're partners, but we're not allies. And so what that means is that it's far more important, particularly for the Air Force and for the Navy as well, to have to employ soft power, what I've called air power diplomacy. And so for the Air Force, that's a lot of things. And I think this is where a lot of people, and this is what my point in responding to Professor Farley was that, so for example, the Air Force has a what they call the 2012 Building Partnership Strategy, where they lay out something like 60 different activities or missions or engagement activities that they undertake to build relationships and to assist. And it's not just military to military. They have civil aviation teams that they send, that they're wanting to send out. I don't think that this is a full-up program yet, where they help develop modern civil aviation in countries that have less developed systems. And the idea here is that the United States builds goodwill with these countries, that for American air power, if it needed to surge forward, that a more advanced civil aviation system is good for the U.S. Air Force, and it also helps these countries defend themselves and brings them into, when it comes to, you know, whether it's China or the United States, we're hoping to build that kind of goodwill towards the United States. And so these types of activities, you know, at the Air War College and in Montgomery, something like a third of the students there are foreign students. So it's professionalization. There was something that the Air Force kind of worked on back in the 90s and early 2000s called the Global Community of Airmen. And the idea was that if you had professionalized air forces, that you would have, and if you look historically, military men in adversarial countries who have had interactions, say, look at the Japanese Navy leadership prior to World War II, where they said, hey, look, you know, you shouldn't attack the United States. We've been there. We understand how powerful they are. This is a bad idea. And so this is not the only example. And so the idea for the Air Force was, if we can have these foreign Air Force officers who are likely to be senior leaders in their air forces, they'll understand what it would mean to potentially fight the United States, and then what also it would mean to be a friend, a partner, or an ally of the United States. And so that's a soft power or an air diplomacy activity, or, you know, the show the flag missions, or all sorts of things. And so when Professor Farley wrote his article about how the Navy was much better at this, it struck me as somewhat inappropriate in terms of the fact that it undervalued the many things that the Air Force has been doing and is in the process of expanding. So I think that's some of the background in terms of how you bring that all into air-sea battle And so as the United States surges forward, it will need friends, and it will need to know that it can count on those friends to let them put bases in places if a shooting war were to happen with a country in the region.
Let me go back a second to you've talked about the global commons in your work, and you've adopted a much broader definition than I think many people in the Navy have. Can you kind of explain your global commons definition and how the Air Force fits into that?
I'm not sure if I understand your question in the way that you mean to be asking it.
Well, for most Navy people, the global commons involves the major sea lanes and sea routes and the open ocean area that belongs to no particular nation. In your work, you've discussed both the maritime global commons and an air global commons and a space global commons and a cyber global commons. And I'm interested in that expansion, and I'm kind of asking you to kind of, you know, just touch on what that means.
Well, I mean, this is something that's it's really quite a debate right now in terms of the very concept of Michelle Flournoy, whenever she left the Center for New American Security and went to be the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. She wrote an article in Proceedings about the global commons and the role of the United States in the global commons. And I guess there's one of the things that my thoughts have been kind of evolving over time, particularly in cyberspace, has really made me think a lot about this. And one of the things that I'm coming to believe is in the sovereignization of cyberspace. So whereas most people believe that cyberspace is this kind of global common, extends around the globe, I personally, as my thoughts and understanding evolve, am coming to believe that cyberspace is less a global common than many people think, and that it is appropriate for countries to essentially develop a sovereign cyber domain within their countries. And then as I think about air, I mean, air is not really, there is a global common in terms of the air when we think about transiting in international airways, but in an air domain, if you think about some of these shoot downs that have occurred over Russian territory, I can't remember it was a Korean Airlines flight, and what was that, 1988?
Yeah, KAL 007.
Right. I mean, so the air domain, there's 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water, but 100% is covered by air. So there's a role for air everywhere, but I'm beginning to think that there's less global common than we often think. And one of the things that I have been thinking is that in terms of global commons, that the only reason, so if you think about land, there's no such a thing as a land global common, but there is a sea global common and an air global common and a space global common and a cyber one right now. And my thought is evolving such that I think that the only reason that a global common exists is because nobody's figured out how to dominate it quite yet. And so if you take space, for example, nobody has really been able to effectively weaponize space. But I think once they do, then I think we'll see things change dramatically. Or the air. Nobody can really control the air except for potentially above their own territory. And so as I think about global commons, and this may be taking this in a different direction than where you guys wanted to go, but I think that the global commons in the years ahead will be shrinking, not expanding, or not even staying the same, because I think as technology develops, countries will find ways to dominate and be persistent in increasingly wider areas such that what we now think of as the global commons decreases. And great powers and great states will be the ones who are able to do that.
The comment you made before about the work the U.S. Air Force is doing in developing nations about helping, you know, build their civil authority and getting a presence and, you know, doing what all the services do, some better than others, is developing and establishing relationships with military members, not just from allies but from neutrals and others. In some ways, remind me of some of the concepts of one of our former guests here, and actually he's up in the chat room, Captain Jerry Hendricks, who's gotten mileage out of an article he wrote a few years ago that I thought he did, where he brought up the concept of influence squadron, where, you know, you want to go out and you want to have a presence, you want to build relationships, you want to be able to visit and operate with other nations at a level that they can relate to and they can be comfortable with. And from the naval side of the house, whether you're looking at traditional presence missions, which are carrier battle group off the coast, or if you're looking for what Jerry was referring to, which are the influence squadrons, where you come in with, you know, maybe an amphib, a few other ships, maybe the Coast Guard is involved, you work at their level, you work at those relationships. But when you do that in a Navy sense, you have ships, they're large, they're visible, not just by host nation policymakers and military, but you've got the husbanding agents, you come into port, you see the ships, there's a presence, there's news articles. It has a broader reach. While when you look at air diplomacy in many respects, yeah, you're getting through to maybe a small group of professionals, people who see a blip on a radar screen or somebody who sits in the classroom, but it doesn't quite seem to have the same broader visibility to the host nation's public in general in a larger strategic message. Is that something that there are perhaps other assets in the Air Force that if you're looking to get a broader message to the people of a host country, that might be a bit more effective than some of the micro examples that you used before?
Well, I think, so I did a study on where should the Air Force have bases overseas in the next 25 years. And one of the things that we looked at in conducting this study was the domestic publics of foreign nations. And so one of the things you find is, you find that around U.S. Army bases overseas, soldiers tend to be, and the United States in particular, tends to be unpopular. Now, there are those who financially benefit from the sale of things to U.S. soldiers. But in general, the countries where you have more than just the local, but the national domestic publics of those countries tend to not want those bases there, and then the U.S. tends to be less popular. And again, I think Okinawa is a great example. They want a much reduced Marine presence. So the reason I offer this example is that the Air Force tends to have this problem to a much lesser degree in its overseas bases. And this goes back to your broader point, in that oftentimes it's a good thing to have less impact on the publics of foreign nations where you may be operating. And so one of the things about air power diplomacy is that you're not necessarily targeting everybody. You're really targeting the people that you want to specifically influence. And so the air power is really good about this. And so when it comes to, like, for example, overseas bases tend to have a less negative impact on the local populations because they tend to be more remote, they tend to have fewer personnel, you get a different type of personnel than you would at an Army or Marine base. And so when it comes to overseas basing, we see that the United States tends to have less of a negative image in places where you have Air Force bases as opposed to Army posts. And so I bring this up because I wouldn't necessarily equate the types of diplomacy missions that the U.S. Navy may do with the types of diplomacy missions that air power may try to achieve. So they're not really trying to affect the same people for the same reasons. And so the Air Force would do less of a let everybody see you and leave them awed at your capability. It's really about focusing on those decision makers who may be the ones to say, yes, your aircraft can fly operations out of here when you need to go and do something in a country that is in close proximity. So you're targeting a more narrowly focused group of people. And then also, if you think about where the U.S. is popular, because we generally, Americans, want the U.S. to be popular. So if you think about the Middle East, and there's a public opinion survey that they do every year throughout the Middle East. It's related to the Pew Foundation and their the public opinion polling that they do. And you'd be surprised to know that the country in the Middle East where the United States is the most popular is Iran. And one of the reasons where, and this is with, you know, the average population, it's of course not with the leadership. We're very unpopular with the Iranian leadership. But the reason we're very popular with Iranians in general is because we haven't been there since 1979. So the fact that we haven't been there and we haven't been involved in the domestic politics and in the, you know, the machinations of the country as a much more popular nation in their minds. And so the reason I suggest this is that by having less of a large footprint and less of a large presence, I would argue that's good for American diplomacy. And that's one of the things that I would argue the air power provides you.
I would argue that's also one of the things that having aircraft carriers and a Navy provides. There's no footprint left by a carrier that is based someplace else. But let me address another issue, which is if the idea is to reduce our footprint and yet maintain the power, doesn't that put us in the position, given the long distances involved, say, on our pivot to the Pacific, with the need to have more domestic bases in areas that are more accessible to the east, as in Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, so that we can keep our footprint and our own first island chain or second island chain? And is that contemplated in the view you see of the Air Force diplomacy?
Well, I think really what the Air Force is going to have to do is it's almost going to have to be much like, you know, if you go, you know, you see the movies where there's a guy on the streets of New York and he's got three cups and then he's got a, you know, he's got a ball under one cup and he's shuffling it around. So during the Cold War, we had a lot of cold bases where we could go in and open up the bases and conduct operations from there. But when we weren't using them, they were minimally manned and they were oftentimes owned by the host country. So what I would argue for air power's sake is the U.S. doesn't want to own all of the bases. Because in bases that the U.S. owns, so for example, take a base and take Kadena Air Base in Japan. In that base, Japan pays about half or so of the total cost of that base. But yet it's still twice as expensive for the United States to be in that base than it would be to have a base in the United States. And so my point is that overseas bases owned by Americans are really expensive. We pay high labor rates to the locals. They overinflate charges for the United States. They're really expensive. So what I would advocate is that with air power diplomacy, you build the kinds of relationships you need, and you have, and this is one area where I took from the Navy, so the Navy's port calls. What I would advocate is that the Air Force doesn't have a tradition of regular deployments much like the Navy does. Well, you know that every 18 months you're going to deploy, you're going to do a WestPac, you're going to do a Med Cruise. what I would advocate is that the Air Force needs to do something akin to what the Navy does. And so perhaps there's a specific squadron that will do regular deployments to, you know, Malaysia, for example. And so those squadrons get to know the Malay Air Force officers, and they get to know the air bases that they're flying in and out of. They get to know what it's like to work with Malay Air Forces, and that you have a U.S. Air Force that is capable of doing those types of deployments to the bases in the region and working with the air forces in the region, and yet they're not American air bases, and they're not owned by the United States, but because of the relationships the United States has with those countries, and because the United States knows and understands what capabilities exist in the region, if it's time for the United States to surge forward, it has essentially the capacity to do so. And that's where I kind of think part of the air power diplomacy mission is in building that relationship and developing that understanding of local bases, local air forces, et cetera.
Kind of somewhere between that and soft power and hard power, something that, you know, we've been watching for the last few weeks. And there's one thing we've talked about here a few times from the Navy point of view. I call it the unsexy but important equipment. And we all saw, especially before 9/11, everybody was always trying to kill the C-130J. They couldn't find a time fast enough to stop production line of the C-17. And the CH-47 helicopter was going to be languishing as well. But the utility of those aircraft from an international point of view, you know, now we see the UK have them, NATO's buying them, the UK. And in Mali, one of the things we saw that our allies really needed was transport. U.S. C-17s, British C-17s, you name 130 variant, it was going out there to help the French. We all saw similar things for transporting equipment during the Libyan operations. But when you look at the C-130J and the C-17 and on the Air Force side of the house, the CH-47, it seems that a lot of the intellectual effort in the Air Force has been spent screaming for the F-22, finding as much money possible for the F-35, but has not really, even though General Schwartz came from a cargo background, they still seem to be underselling the unsexy but important side of the equation. Are they doing enough to advertise that along the lines of what you're referring to for soft power and presence operations? Or is there still a mindset where if it doesn't carry a weapon, it's really not worth advertising as much?
Well, no, I've written a few other. I've got another article out that just came out in the forum, International Affairs Forum, that talks about air power diplomacy with China. Because we actually, the United States and the United States Air Force actually engages in air power diplomacy with China. So the Air Force has a version of the Air and Space Power Journal that, you know, it's in Mandarin. And so this is, you know, information sharing back and forth where U.S. Air Force officers and Chinese Air Force officers can engage in dialogue because they can't engage otherwise. And in that article, the thing that myself and my co-author open up with is after the earthquakes that hit China, I guess it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, the first into the region were Air Force C-17s that were flying in water and supplies. And because of the capability of those airlifters, the Air Force could get into remote places that nobody else could get into. And so if you look in terms of Haiti, or if you look in terms of Turkey when they had the earthquakes a few years ago, one of the first, you know, groups of folks that you'll find that are coming into these areas is Air Force C-17s bringing in water and food and, you know, other things like that. So I think that there's it's a mission that does occur. That's a diplomatic mission, of course, whenever you do that. So, for example, and this is where the Navy and the Air Force had they really fundamentally reshaped U.S. relations with a country. So I was deployed. I was deployed with a Marine regiment, and we were going to the Gulf, and we were transiting the Strait of Malacca when the Christmas tsunami hit a few years ago, and our little Mew got recast to go to Banda Aceh after the earthquake hit because we were right there in the area, and started flying water in to Indonesia and doing relief operations. And at the same time, the Air Force, C-17, were bringing in supplies and food. And prior to that, I guess that was Christmas 2004, and prior to that tsunami, Indonesia and the United States had really poor relations. The Indonesians were very suspicious of the United States. But after the U.S. Navy and the Air Force really came in and contributed and provided really good relief efforts and really helped the Indonesians, those really cold relations have fundamentally changed. And the U.S. and Indonesia have developed quite good relations in the years since. So I think those are diplomacy activities that both services do. And in some instances, they can be underappreciated, or they're not seen perhaps as much as we would like. So when the Air Force does these operations and they fly in relief supplies, I think it just goes unnoticed quite frequently.
In the Air Force strategic vision for 2020 to 2030, it talks about kind of a two-level Air Force, one of which is let me see how that's described, a flexible force that general purpose force, accustomed to operating with allies. Do you have any idea what that means, and exactly is that part of the diplomacy you're talking about? And what kind of aircraft or units would that involve?
Well, I mean, the Air Force, a general purpose force is principally the combat Air Force. So that's, in 20 years, that's the combat Air Force is principally going to be F-35s, a few S-22s, a very small bomber force. And then the Air Force actually has, a very large mobility force. So when you talk mobility, you're talking your C-130s, your C-17s, your 135s. That's your mobility force. And that's actually larger than the Air Force would like. The Air Force would like to reduce its mobility force, but because of where these aircraft are produced and the clout of members of Congress, the Air Force has forced them continue purchasing aircraft it doesn't want. And then, of course, the Army would like the Air Force to have a large mobility fleet because it would prefer its stuff to get shipped by air as opposed to by sea because it gets there quicker. So everybody would like the Air Force to be its cargo hauler. So that's kind of the general purpose force. The diplomacy, when we talk air diplomacy, in many respects, this is taking the same assets but performing a different mission. So much like the Navy, you can use the same ships to, you can launch a Tomahawk strike, or you can pull into a port and build those kind of relations. You can do much the same with the same airmen and the same aircraft. That's, I guess, what I would say is, how to think about the general purpose force. But one thing I would say about the Air Force, in many respects, I think that the Air Force has forgotten because of the last decade of supporting a principally a ground war in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think it's forgotten what it exists to do. And I don't think many people really understand why you have a United States Air Force. The United States Air Force principally exists. One Air Force officer, he said, "Hey, Adam, look, here's how you describe what we do. We go deep." And I thought, that's really a great way, because the whole reason that the Air Force was created with the during the Key West agreements, in which the Air Force then its role was negotiated, it was created basically as a strategic bombing service. That is its principal role. Its principal role is not to provide close air support to the Army. Its principal role is not to haul stuff for the Army. Its principal role is not to be a diplomatic service. Its principal role is to be a strategic bombing force, or a strategic strike. So you can think in terms of ICBMs, or if in the coming years the Air Force gets what they're calling prompt global strike, which is a conventional ICBM force. But that's really what the Air Force's role is. And so as I think about the Air Force and the Navy, I see it as that the Air Force's role is long-range strike. The Navy's role is persistent presence. So it's a strategic force as well. The Marine Corps, I see, is an amphibious force that gains ground access. And then the role of the Army is, they invade, occupy, and rebuild. That's essentially what the Army does. And I guess George Friedman wrote a book called The Next 100 Years. And there's one thing that he said, he talked about Japan attacking the United States from moon bases, and he talked about Turkey being the great power of Europe. But so some of it's a little farcical. But he said one thing that's important. He said, look, for the United States, it doesn't have to invade and occupy and hold territory to defend its interests over the next century. And I think he's right. And if the United States doesn't have to invade, occupy, and hold territory, that means it's going to be up to the Navy and the Air Force to be the services that principally are responsible for defending the nation's interest.
There's always a fine line between preparing to fight your last war and not forgetting the lessons that you earned with a lot of blood and treasure in the last war, and then having to recreate it out of whole cloth and the next one comes along. You mentioned close air support. Especially in the early parts of the conflict, people discovered that, yes, you can take a straight stick F-15 and use it for close air support. That cannon's a wonderful weapon to use against infantry. But when you look at our experience in Iraq, in Afghanistan, from an air power perspective, what are some of those lessons you think that our nation and the Air Force in particular should really hoist on board, examine, and integrate into its future plans? And what requirements or experiences did they have in Iraq and Afghanistan should be looked at as probably unique requirements and experiences, and probably don't need to be a priority looking forward to prepare for whatever comes next?
Well, I think if Afghanistan and Iraq teach us anything, what they teach us is that absent a clearly defined set of vital national interests. So the United States really, if you look at the national security strategy, the United States has no clearly defined set of national interests. I would argue that you have vital national interest, major national interest, and peripheral national interest. Your vital national interests are the ones you will not negotiate, and they're the ones you go to war for. Your major interests are the ones that are negotiable, but they're the ones that you would employ maybe limited force, maybe you would use embargoes or economic sanctions or other measures. and peripheral interests are largely the ones that are symbolic or moral, but yet you're not going to fight for them, and you're not really going to do anything substantive to defend them. So take Rwanda, for example, the bloodshed in Rwanda in 1994. That was a peripheral interest to the U.S. It was horrible what happened. We were all shocked by it, but we weren't going to go to Rwanda to stop it. You look at something like, say, Taiwan, for example. I would say Taiwan is probably a major interest for the United States. And so the United States will sell arms to Taiwan. It will do the best it can to enable Taiwan to defend itself against the PRC. But the reality of the United States going to war with the PRC to stop China from taking Taiwan is probably pretty small. And then a vital interest would be, you know, nuclear deterrence, for example. And so my point is that prior to Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States doesn't have a clearly defined set of national interests that span presidents, they're not partisan, that they are understood, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, that these are the things that matter most to this country. And these are the things that we have to defend and protect. And so when you have presidents come to power, so for example, as I looked at national security strategies, the first one in a president's, they come out every 4 years and they come out within about a year of a president taking office. The first one will say, here's what I want to do, here's how I'm going to make the world a great place. And then the second one, if a president gets reelected, will say, geez, look at all the things I did in the last 4 years. We're going to do even more of this good stuff. And then if the next president is of a different party, his national security strategy will say, we're going to do it different than the last guy, and what we value is different. Now, that gives you no consistency in terms of what matters to your country. And the country is bigger than the president. And I would argue that he does not determine what matters most to the country, that they are bigger than him. And so when the president, after 9/11, we had to respond. So we responded. But yet we never really looked at a consistent set of national interest and say, well, how much is at stake here? How much does this matter to us? And so therefore, how should we respond to it? So for example, I would argue that in the case of Afghanistan, I saw it a little differently. Is I think of where in the world would I want America's worst adversaries to be if I want to marginalize them? I cannot think of a place I would rather them be than in Afghanistan, because it's the most backward place in the country. It's hard to get out of. And so if I could have my adversaries in Afghanistan and periodically use special forces and strategic bombing or other means to it, similar, to attack those adversaries, much like a whack-a-mole, to me, that's the appropriate strategy, and I want to keep them there because it marginalizes them. But we never thought this through because we didn't have a clearly defined set of interests in which we evaluated action in Afghanistan against all the other interests that we had. Or take Iraq, for example. If you think about Iraq, Saddam Hussein, he's clearly a bad guy, and we weren't on good terms in 2003. But if you look at the long-term relationship that the United States had with Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein wanted to come back into the fold of the United States, come back, and we now know that he did many of the things that he told us he had done because he saw his bigger adversary as Iran. And for the United States, the reality is, for us, our bigger adversary was also Iran. And so I think because we didn't have this clearly defined set of interests, we went for the easiest target to make a point, as opposed to taking this longer-term strategic look that was laid against a set of interests that were persistent across administrations. And so while the lessons that I'm essentially offering are not necessarily air power specific, I do think that in terms of the last decade, in this 9/11 and since then, that what I've taken away from that, at least, is that the country really needs to come together to develop a clearly defined set of interests so that as it moves forward and challenges come up in the years ahead, it can lay that challenge against those interests to say, hey, look, this is not something we want to mess with. It's not an interest of ours. You know, let it go. Or it can say, hey, this is something we cannot negotiate. You know, we have to prepare for war, or whatever the action or response may be.
Well, as you see the future, what does the Air Force look like? You know, we've got a piece out, and I know about 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Well, I think it's principally going to be a tactical force, because the Air Force has a lot invested on the F-35, and it's not just the United States. I mean, this is a program that is part of the effort to bring prices down. This is a joint program that has, you know, many countries in Europe, the Canadians. It's a multinational program, so it's much harder to back out of this program now. And, you know, the F-35, I think the first cost estimates I heard were something like $65 million per aircraft, and now it's, you know, $125 million plus. So I think this F-35 program, the Joint Strike Fighter, is eating up much of the R&D and acquisition budget of the service, and so therefore it's going to have a lot of F-35s. And within 10 years, I don't see the services having banded its strategic, its long-range strike capabilities. That may come later. But you're going to have a lot of air mobility, your airlifters. Maybe you'll start to have new aerial refueling capabilities. But you'll have a lot of tactical combat aviation. And so that's kind of what I see the Air Force looking like, kind of its capabilities.
From looking really far down the road to something that's kind of right in front of our face, and a lot of this might be the self-referral problem here, but as somebody with a nautical background, a nautically focused part of the country, with sequestration come up, it seems the Navy has been pretty upfront, almost political in the sense it's go, okay, this is what's going to happen. We're not deploying a carrier. And, oh, yeah, that other carrier that needs to be refueled, now we're not going to do that either. Some really high-profile announcements trying to put some fact and some reality to what sequestration might mean in DOD. I haven't heard much from the Air Force or the Army about how that's going to impact them to the degree carrier battle groups not deploying and carriers delaying their refueling. What is the Air Force looking at, and are they being as vocal as the Navy is being, or successful in getting the word out as the Navy is being about the impacts of sequestration, or am I just reading the wrong things?
It's interesting. I think when it comes to how the services deal with the political aspect, I mean, this is a political issue. And so as I look at the services and how they deal with political issues, I think the Navy is one of the more adept at the politics of Washington. They're really quite good at it. And I think the Army is even better, because, you know, they'll wave the bloody handkerchief whenever the argument starts going against them. And that's almost like their trump card. I think the Air Force is perhaps the most subdued in their political efforts. And so the things that the Air Force is potentially looking to do, for example, they're looking to furlough their civilian employees, so there'll be furloughs. They're looking to terminate a lot of contracts or to not renew contracts. They're reducing research and development. They are looking at not flying, cutting all training flights for the last few months of the fiscal year. So you'll have a lot less flying, and so therefore pilots will, and potentially in any given year, pilots will have less airtime. So that's some of the ways. And then, of course, you'll have to reduce the buys of your, you know, the Air Force is a platform-dependent service. You know, every Marine is a rifleman. Well, the Air Force, you know, is heavily dependent upon equipment and highly advanced and expensive equipment. So you'll just have to start cutting those buys over the long term. And so that's, I think, how the service is kind of addressing the potential for sequestration.
What have you got? You got more? You just mentioned a fairly recent article. Have you got other articles that are pending, and any other big things we should be looking for down the road from you?
Well, I published something on called "From the Air: Rediscovering Our Raison d'Etre" a few months ago, about 6 months ago, in the Air and Space Power Journal, and that's basically where I laid out what I think the Air Force is doing, what it should be doing, and what its real mission is, and how I think it's kind of gotten off track. And I think that's one of the, you know, that goes into a lot about how I see the Air Force and you know, what its purpose is. But then also, I just had a book on deterrence come out that came out in December on the role of deterrence, be it nuclear, cyber, how deterring non-state actors, you know, what is the role of deterrence in the 21st century as we have all these new threats and the evolving geostrategic environment. And then I've got a book coming out in June, I think, that's going to focus on the national security implications of cyber. And so cyber is really becoming one of the hottest topics within, you probably read that U.S. Cyber Command is going to grow fivefold in the next few years, whenever the other services and, you know, other DoD organizations are shrinking, CyberCom is growing. So you can see where DoD is seen as a growth industry and is really concerned. So I think those are some of the things I'm working on. And, you know, some of the areas where DOD at least thinks that there are some significant areas for concern.
You just drew me off, Mike. We're coming up here, 3 minutes left. Maybe we can talk fast. I was going to talk about the crazy aunt in the basement, nuclear weapons. But you brought up something that I hear a lot as well. A lot of people talk about cyber, and that's fine, and I agree with a lot of it. But we talk about how important cyber is, what a threat and a danger being the recipient of a cyber attack is, yet at the same time, we continue to design and implement systems that are heavily reliant on networks, whether they're celestial or line of sight, IP-based. We talk about having drones where analysis is done off-board, reliant on satellite communications, ground stations. Again, all this is computer-based.
Right.
Are we setting ourselves up to creating such an exquisitely designed in peacetime system, and I'm talking about we, DOD, Navy, and Air Force are parallel in this, and what we're really doing is we're setting up a vulnerability that we know is there, but we think we're immune to it because we're used to being top dog. I have a significant concern about the vulnerabilities that we're baking into our cake here, and I do not see an appreciation of that in any way, shape, or form about, okay, that's great, what is your offline mode, and people blink at you. What are your thoughts?
Well, it may transform the nature of warfare. If you think about cyber, the DoD is more protected in its networks than the private sector. But so if you look at like critical infrastructure, you know, when it comes to the operating systems of power plants and water and sewage, those things are, you know, I don't think that we're going to have a Cybergeddon that's going to be from some fat kid in a basement. That's just highly unlikely. But if you look at the People's Liberation Army, they have more people dedicated to cyber than the size than there are infantrymen in the Marine Corps. So you have countries that are really understand, and they call it informationized warfare in the Chinese military literature. So they're really focusing on this, and they're saying, well, what can we do to the U.S. to hurt them? How can we make it impossible for them to get here? And so the first salvos in a strike in, 10 or 20 or 30 years are certainly going to be, and it's going to be more than just espionage. It will be shutting down systems. If you think about the timing signals we get from the GPS constellation, if you can shut off those timing signals, you're not using ATMs. Your power company isn't going to run because power generation systems operate off of those GPS timing signals. So there's a lot of harm that you can do, and you can basically turn, our eye off the ball onto dealing with the cyber strikes. You can. There were some reports in open sources here recently about how when a ship pulls to the pier and it plugs in, it plugs into the power and network on the pier, that some hackers had been able to hack into that ship's generators and overloaded the generators and caused the generators to explode. And so while cyber is not going to lead to mass casualties, it can certainly cause a lot of problems. You might be able to spoof aircraft. You might be able, if you can penetrate radars, you might be able to make that radar not see a target that it should normally pick up. The potential is really quite extensive for what cyber could do.
Well, Adam, we've run out of time. Imagine that. Hey, I really appreciate you taking the opportunity here to join us this Sunday. And what other plans do you have going on this year?
Well, I think a lot of folks in Washington and elsewhere are just looking to see what sequestration has in store. And I think, most of those folks, I'm just waiting to see what happens before I make any big plans.
Probably a good call. Well, thanks again, and we look forward to reading your stuff down the road.
Thanks, fellas. Enjoy coming on.
And I want to thank everybody.
Thanks again.
And thanks, everybody, for joining. And we look forward to seeing you again next Sunday for another edition of Midrat. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me.